So we'll there's going to be four lectures in this series. This is the first one, which is kind of introductory, and we can look at there's not that much Indian stuff. I decided not to do that this time. It's going to be mostly phenomenology and history of holiness today in theology, really. So the development of the category and that kind of thing, and raising questions really about what it means. Well, I'm delighted at the interest in holiness. I thought it was a rather obscure subject. But are people...
Why is holiness obscure?
Why is holiness obscure? Well, there's not much around. But I suppose I could make a start without the handouts. So these lectures will inquire what we mean, into what we mean by holiness, the category holiness. And by focusing mostly on discussions in phenomenology and hermeneutics. But so why be interested in holiness? There's been recent interest in the category. One is the Pope gave a, 2018 gave a, an encyclical on the notion of holiness, which caused some interest in the Catholic world. And there's Mittelman wrote an interesting, or edited an interesting book on holiness in Judaism a couple of years ago. And Giorgio Agamben, whose work I enjoy, wrote a book, Homo Sacer. You passed one on to me. Thank you. Good, I can see what I'm doing. So this isn't, Homo Sacer. So we're going to engage with that, not this week, but the next time we'll talk about Agamben's project and the sacred man, Homo Sacer category. And then I suppose in a wider history, you've got on the one hand, someone like Rudolf Otto wrote that famous book on holiness, and he locates holiness in feeling and, creature feeling and a feeling of overwhelming power, the numinosity that comes upon you. And Agamben writes this book and says you can't reduce holiness to the triviality of goosebumps. So he sees it as a political category to the detriment of humanity, because holiness, the category, the holy man, leads to concentration camps. That's Agamben's argument. So we'll be looking at that next time. So he has a completely negative appraisal of the category. So the project is to look at, reorientate the notion of holiness between these two extremes, in a sense, I suppose. So, and this is the beginning. So there was, anyone read Virginia Woolf's The Waves? Years ago, there was about halfway through, the teacher who's come to retirement, and they're kicking him out. And he says, what am I going to do? Am I going to go and clip yew hedges in the West Country? And then he says, what massive forces have led to this present moment now? What massive forces? He says, he repeats it. And so in a sense, that's an interesting question. What are the massive forces that led the teacher to that particular situation? So that's a question of constraint. So I always think, my old teacher, John Barker, used to talk about constraint. So what are the constraints that lead to the eventuality of whatever it is that you're in? What are the constraints that led to you being here right now? What are the massive forces, if you like? I mean, in one sense, the question of holiness, I think, is a question of the specification of constraints. What kind of constraint is holiness that leads to the particularity of any human situation? So that's the kind of question that I want to look at. So that's why it's a kind of phenomenological study. So what does holiness add, if you like, to the specification of constraints? And what explanatory power does it hold such that the contemporary world, we should even be concerned with it? Why bother with holiness now, in 2022? And can we even specify holiness as a constraint in the sense that this might imply something that we can apply like a method to a realm of life? And what sort of constraint could holiness be? So those are the general questions. And my broad claim, I suppose, is that holiness is a category with contemporary relevance insofar as it indicates invisible constraint upon human life that can be traced through history and philosophically justified. So naming invisible light is the specification of constraint, the naming of holiness as a theme in human reality. So Heidegger, in his in a book, Introduction to Phenomenology, an early book, says, I'm going to read this bit because, excuse me, getting my, I bought these, 15 quid they cost me yesterday. A phenomenon means something that shows itself, while phenomenai, the verb, is to show itself, with phaino meaning to bring something to the light of day. This is on the handout. Where the stem pha is related to pho, light or daylight. Now, re-describing Aristotle, Heidegger notes that daylight is something that lets something be seen, something else be seen, through it as a transparency that is not itself visible, but that is in the manner of the presence of something. So I thought that was interesting because it seems to be analogous, daylight seems to be analogous to the category holiness in the sense that daylight allows something to be seen, but cannot itself be seen. So I think holiness is a bit like that. It allows something, things to be, certain kinds of things to be seen, but or perceived or experienced, but cannot itself be experienced. So one of the important issues then is the relation of what shows itself, what appears, to the real, to what exists. So I wish to draw an initial parallel between the categories of phenomenon and holiness. So that was part of this initial project, because both contain an ambiguity, on the one hand being an intellectual object of perception, on the other being a medium through which objects of perception appear. So daylight, is that can that be an intellectual object of inquiry? I suppose it can in some sense. And I think holiness is parallel to that. So I'm taking holiness as an intellectual object, if you like, as an object of phenomenology. So holiness can be named, I would claim, as an intellectual object of perception, an encounter through the image, through the place and through the person, yet holiness, like light, is invisible. So this naming of invisible light is to expose a history of numinosity, and naming holiness as invisible light means the identification and specification of constraint that has been central to the historical formations we call religions. So I am arguing that there are analogues to the category in other civilizations. It's not just a Christian idea. So there are two questions then. So it's not a reprising of Otto's project, because he stripped the category of any political content or any political ramifications. I don't think we can do that. So it's always embroiled in politics, both positive and negative. So when the Pope calls for the Third Crusade, that's a political act, but it's also regarded conceptually as a holy act. When the 9/11 bombers, they thought that what they were doing was holy in some sense. So it's not morally neutral, and it's not positive. It has a negative dimension, as Agamben has highlighted. So there are two questions I think we need to look at. For whom is holiness an appearance, and of what? So I want to look at those two questions, not today, but in the coming weeks. For whom? What is the community of reception for the category holiness, or the individual, and of what? What appears? What is it that this holiness is an appearance of? This invisible reality, this invisibility, what is that? And generally, I would offer this would be the last lecture, a metaphysically realist position that regarding holiness, but it can only be perceived in its instantiations. You can never get at holiness independent of any kind of representation or any image. So what is holiness? The broad semantic range of the term holiness, it refers to a quality of places, things and people set aside from everyday transaction and regarded as the expression of a source transcendent to the human world or an intellectual object towards which certain practices are orientated. So sometimes it's considered coterminous with goodness. I wouldn't like to say that at the moment. And there's a debate, particularly in Jewish philosophy, about whether it's a quality of a moral quality, whether it entails morality or whether it doesn't. So for Otto, it was an amoral power, but for Jewish philosophers like Heschel, holiness entails morality. It entails being a good person, and maybe there's something to that, but we'll see as we go on. So to state my claim as succinctly as I can at this early stage, I think I can read from the bottom of page 2. Holiness is primarily a term that denotes an orientation, impulse and process in human persons towards openness, verticality, transformation, fullness, completion, perfectibility, or in an earlier language, transcendence. Secondarily, holiness denotes a quality of particular places and times, often linked to the image. Holiness is attributed to centres of pilgrimage, such as the Kaaba, or Canterbury Cathedral, or St. Margaret's Well at Binsey. And this might include secular sites, such as the Cenotaph in London. So I think holiness goes beyond religion, in a sense. It's a wider cultural phenomenon, and it's worth highlighting beyond religion, if you like, in what we would call secular situations. And it's also associated with time, with the calendrical year and certain times in the narrative of a life, birth, marriage, death. We highlight these as holy, and some people do in some circumstances, including grand funerals for the head of state. So that was interesting, I thought. You know, I was in London. I don't know if any of you went to the queue and joined the queue, but there was one lady, she went through, then she got to the end, and she went back again and did it twice, you know. So there's something compelling about that situation, and something that I would, I think we can attribute the category holiness to it for those people involved in it. Although it's a secular thing. And behind this is creeping in underneath the radar is an Indian model from a tradition called the Krama, the Gradation School. I won't be talking about this in these lectures, but they have a notion of what they call the sky of consciousness, Chidgagana. And the purpose of Chidgagana, the sky of consciousness, is a cosmic meaning, if you like, and it's not only up in there in the sky, but it's all around us, and it's invisible in a sense. And the purpose of life is to become open to the sky of consciousness through text and practice. And I thought that was very interesting. I mean, this is very early text. You've got feudal system, you've got caste system, you've got criminals being impaled on stakes, and yet there's this tradition coming up with this incredible sort of expansive vision of the world, you know. And I did wonder about this, because they use this word drimbana or vidrimbana, which I thought was yawning, you know. So I asked Alexis Sanderson, I thought I'd better make sure. And he says, yeah, it means yawning, but it doesn't mean that here, you cretin. It means being open, it means openness. So it's used figuratively. So I thought, so that's great. I mean, that's just what I want. Used figuratively. So in a parallel way, openness. So that's the model. I kind of taken that Indian model and kind of used it as a basis for some of this, really. So it's becoming open to the unnameable, the anarchia, which is also the chidgagana, the sky of consciousness. And you become a caterer, a mover in the sky of consciousness through becoming open. So I think that's very interesting, that whole notion of openness, because it implies vulnerability, it implies freedom, it implies... what's that word that Judith Butler uses? Precarity, and lots of things. You can develop a phenomenology of holiness as a phenomenology of openness, I think. But anyway, that's going into future talks. So to speak about the for whom and the of what of holiness is inevitably to make a broad statement that claims relevance across civilizations. And to discuss the for whom something is holy does not mean that we need to describe the multiple ways in which holiness shows itself to human communities, but rather indicates the need to abstract and specify certain kinds of constraint that operate in all human communities, such as temporality, being born and dying, the need for sustenance, the need to make sense of our life, and eschatological hope. So when Virginia Woolf's schoolteacher asks about the massive forces bearing down upon him, and this is the question about what are the constraints that control our life into its particularity. And holiness is a central constraint that impels us to certain acts and pulls us towards cosmic meaning, towards what Gabriel Marcel has characterized as transcendence, going beyond ourselves, yet still within human experience. So that's the introduction. And in the next last half hour, I want to talk about the scholastic debate, go back to the Middle Ages. So to begin our inquiry and to develop a phenomenology of holiness, I think we need some sense of context and the history of what's at stake. Who's been concerned about the question or why? So in this opening lecture, I'm already 20 minutes into it, I wish to focus on history through a question that will emerge as central to a phenomenology of holiness, namely, what is the intellectual object of a phenomenology of holiness? What's the intellectual object? Can it be an intellectual object? And the related questions as to the being of holiness, whether it can be understood analogically or univocally. And these issues go back a long way, particularly to the medieval scholasticism. So holiness is a category developed within the history of Christianity, and that still has contemporary use, as we see within the Pope's reinvigoration of the category in recent years. So our guiding questions concerning the for whom and the of what is holiness in appearance are questions that have been hotly contested throughout this history and developed within a Christian anthropology. So I suppose if we go back to Avicenna, Avicenna was an Islamic philosopher. I can't remember his dates, I'm afraid. Anyone remember Avicenna? No. Anyways, before... you should know. he was before before Aquinas. Avicenna, Aquinas, he calls him the philosopher in response. Does he call him the philosopher? Or the scholar? Sorry, I can't remember. Anyone doing theology? No?
Dates 980 to
1037. Oh, there we are. In the age of Google, it's terrific, yeah. And Aquinas uses the response to Avicenna. So Avicenna raises the question about metaphysics. He asks, what is metaphysics? What's the subject of metaphysics? Now, by subject, he means what I would call the intellectual object. What's the intellectual object of metaphysics? And he says three things. First of all, that metaphysics, the first thing about metaphysics is its immateriality. It's not material. It's invisible. And the second thing about metaphysics is that it seeks natural causes and inquires into the doctrine that depends on these, along with the principle of principles, which is God, the Most High, says Avicenna. So metaphysics does inquire into the causes. What's the cause of causes? That's the Most High, that's God. And a third feature, says Avicenna, is that this science is a first philosophy because it verifies the principle of all the other sciences, and so is a kind of wisdom. And on this account, God is the proper intellectual object of metaphysics. But almost immediately, Avicenna seems to change his mind, and he complexifies the issue and counters this view, raising the question of how God could be such an object. How can God be the intellectual object of metaphysics? Because God exceeds all predication. So it's a science with a weird intellectual object, if God is that intellectual object. So it's a bit like theology, I suppose. If God is unknowable, then God can't be the intellectual object of theology, because that's unknowable. So theology is a science without subject matter. And as I've always thought, theologians are ones who do not know what they are talking about. But therefore, what is theology? It must be related to it can't be about God. It must be about revelation then. And once it's about revelation, it's brought into culture and history. So you've got so you can have theology as that kind of discussion. Aquinas, of course, is reading Avicenna through in Latin translation. So Avicenna goes on, no science can determine the pre-comprehension of its object. There is a pre-understanding that inevitably cannot be objectified or thematized, because it's the precondition of understanding, he says. So because God is not a body, nor the power of a body, and is separate from matter, he cannot be the topic or the subject of scientific inquiry in any usual sense. God, as the first cause, cannot be the intellectual of metaphysics because of this, his boundlessness. Such objects are the effects of causes and ultimately of a single cause. There is a unity and universality to the subject, to the topic, that underlies the multiplicity of differentiated objects of intention and inquiry, he says. Now, as first cause which flows from all beings, God cannot be the subject or the intellectual object of metaphysics. Okay, got that point. So metaphysics has almost an impossible task to inquire into ultimate causes, while yet not being able to determine or specify the features of such causes, especially the first cause. So if Avicenna is right, and God cannot be the intellectual object of metaphysics or indeed of theology, then we might characterize theology not so much as theory, logos of God, theos, or even as faith seeking understanding, but rather as reflection on revelation. Then the inquiry is brought into culture and history, and I think that's what theology must be. So the theory of God becomes a reflection on the history of the representation of God, a representation that is necessarily within culture through the mediation of symbolic forms. A theology of holiness would therefore also need to be a theology of culture, in which the intellectual object of theology is revelation, and by extension the cultural history in which it occurs and that flows from it. And this is by necessity a modern view in which culture has become an area of inquiry. It must probably no such thing as culture before Vico, was there, or something? But I mean, there obviously was culture, like there was architecture, there was no word for it. So I think probably theology is a bit like that. Now, Duns Scotus, roll on several hundred years, about 1290, something like that. I think he was, Duns Scotus was a theologian giving lectures here in Oxford in about 1300. Do you know Duns Scotus, anyone? Everyone heard of Duns Scotus? You know, okay. Yeah, well, Duns Scotus was a theologian from Scotland, from Duns in Scotland. And he was brilliant. He was brilliant. He was clever bloke who wandering around here. There's actually, I walked past a Cistercian monastery wall And that was built in 1190, this one. There's an arch. And I think, oh, Duns Scotus would probably walk through there, you know, just by the river there. I don't know if you've ever gone along there. But think of Duns Scotus when you next wander around. And Hopkins wrote a poem about Duns Scotus. I can't remember what it's called. Lofty Towers, I think. Do you remember it? Duns Scotus is Oxford. That's it. So Scotus has a definition of theology is the word or reason about God, he says. Well, he's writing in 1300. Today, I don't think that's not good enough. Although in effect, this means that tradition has received the knowledge about God, and the source and inspiration of such theological reflection is the Bible, and so indirectly the Judaic tradition that gave rise to it, and more directly the community that produced the New Testament. So the question as to what it is for God to be an intellectual object is a question that entails the relation of nature to supernature, of natural human faculties, and the capacity of communication that lies outside of human power. It's also a question concerning the ends of human beings. Now, these are big questions, they still are. Now, in discussing the relation between philosophy and theology, Scotus claims that philosophy cannot bring salvation because it does not have an understanding of the last ends of human beings, whereas theology does have such an understanding, and so is the harbinger to salvation. Now, there's a lot at stake, isn't there, in 1300. He's not... I mean, you know, here you choose, you know, do you do philosophy or theology or history or something? It's just an academic subject. But I mean, for him, it was life and death matter, you know, salvation or not. So in the ancient philosophers, if the ancient philosophers claim that the intellect is capable of knowing everything and so becoming everything, an idea that we might translate into a different terminology that the mind takes the form of its objects, I think that's true in India as well, then this implies that all knowledge is natural and the object of the intellect are wholly within nature. So this does not allow for supernatural knowledge. The other perspective is that knowledge, that the objects of the intellect can have supernatural origin, and so human knowledge does not stand wholly within nature. So Scotus discusses all this, particularly in relation to happiness. So God as an intellectual object does not is a cause of happiness. And so it's not simply a condition of knowledge, but is transformative of persons. So on this view, there can't be any methodological agnosticism in suspending the question of the being of God, for God as intellectual object has overwhelming effect. And this idea echoes through to Schleiermacher and to Otto. So why I'm going on about this is that that I missed out a bit on Aquinas in responding to Avicenna, and then Scotus is responding to Aquinas. We just didn't have time for all of that. But the point is, what is the intellectual object of theology? For Avicenna, it can't be God, or there's an ambiguity, because God is overwhelming power. For Aquinas, he rejects that position. He says it can be God, but that God as intellectual object transforms the person. So the study of theology has a transformative effect. And Scotus picks up on this idea as well. So I'm using that as an analogy. What kind of thing is holiness? Is holiness like God an intellectual object? And if so, can we apprehend holiness without being affected by it? So I think these are interesting questions. And if that's the case, then it's always within the realm of interpretation. So, and also that question's the very notion, the very basis of Husserlian phenomenology, that you of the epoche, that you can bracket the being behind appearances. Maybe you can't with the category holiness. I think you can, but anyway, we'll talk about that next time. So, okay, if the mind takes on the forms of its objects, as the medievals thought and as Scotus thought, then holiness as an intellectual object is necessarily transformative. there's an adequation between intellect and thing, adequatio intellectus et rei, a view maintained from Aristotle to the medieval theologians. And I think this is also the predominant view in India as well. It seems to be an Indian view. The mind takes, in Patanjali, the mind takes the forms of its objects. So if your mind is focused, its object is a pure object, then that has transformative effects, like a mantra, or you visualize the image or something. Or likewise, if you're going down the pub every day, the mind takes on the form of that object, you know, and that has a negative, can have a negative effect. So the mind is purified by the purity of its object. The medievals had a doctrine of extramission. I think Sankhya had this too, that there's a, when you, perception, sight is a kind of touching. So as a beam of light goes out of the eye and grabs hold of things. So I think that's also the Sankhya view. They changed that probably about with the Renaissance, I think. But that was the earlier view. So the mind takes the form of its objects. It touches its objects and changes in accordance with its objects. So this relationship between the object of knowledge and knowledge of the object is true, as, and it's called one of the transcendentals. The medievals developed this category of, there were 13 transcendentals, which were like a bit like Platonic ideas, I suppose. And on that view, we cannot bracket out the being behind the appearance of holiness, because holiness has an immediate and transformative effect. You cannot have that an intellectual detachment with holiness. So if that's true, there's a problem for us. This may be true and can become an abductive argument for the being of holiness as a source of human and therefore cultural apprehension of it. But on the other hand, it might not make sense to speak of holiness as an object of consciousness, as God is not really an object of consciousness in the sense that rocks and trees might be so regarded. So I think these are open questions. In Heideggerian terms, if there are various kinds of being, Dasein is human being, the present at hand for objects or things in the world, and the ready to hand is equipment, then the being of holiness is not easily classifiable in these terms. So in Heideggerian classification, you've got Dasein, you and me, you've got the ready to hand, objects, handy objects, equipment, and then you've got objects. And maybe you've got nature, I can't remember. But a holiness, what sort of being is holiness? It's not easily classifiable into those categories. But holiness, I would argue, can be a quality of Dasein, can be a quality of persons. And it can also be a property of something present at hand, of equipment. And it also might be a property of none of these categories. That's really for later lecture. So traditionally, God has resisted classification in these terms, being mostly other to human understanding and not reducible to human ontological categories. But this isn't in the whole story. Methodologically, a phenomenology of holiness needs to proceed at a first level anyway, through a descriptive, non-philosophical and non-theological mode, focus on the languages of the appearances of holiness. But Scotus's question about human ends and the knowledge of God as arising within nature, or something from without it, from supernature, is relevant to the phenomenology of holiness in the judgment about the being of holiness. So if we're trying to understand holiness, we've got these appearances of holiness, but we're actually trying to understand the being of holiness. How do we do that? How can we do that? You can't do it at a first level phenomenology. It can't be that. It must be something else. It must be a deeper engagement. So the fundamental issue is not so much historical impact, although that is important, but the very nature of the human encounter with power other than it, all the transformative events that agents identify as having a transcendent source, or that are overwhelming in contrast to ordinary transactions of serving bodily needs, worries about our relationships, and earning a living, mundane goals of life. Yet to get at the fundamental nature of the human encounter with holiness, we need to look at the question of the being of holiness as we find it in the history of Christian theology as a way into the issues of unpacking what's at stake. So, so far, I hope I'm being clear. We've got what is holiness as a problem, and we've got these two questions of for whom is holiness an appearance, and of what? And of so the first question of what kind of appearance is it? And can we bracket out the being behind holiness, as phenomenology would want to do? And if we go back to Avicenna, he says, no, you can't. If holiness is identified with the Holy One, God, then you can't bracket out. You can't bracket it out because it can't be an intellectual object, in other words. To bracket something out, it's got to be an intellectual object. That's why Husserl says you can't bracket out the subject, you can't bracket the cogito, you can only bracket out the cogitationes or the cogitatum, the being behind the objects of consciousness, but not the subject of consciousness is not subject to the cogito. So likewise, is holiness, can holiness be bracketed or not? And I think I'm trying to draw your attention to an ambiguity about whether it can or not. Okay, so let's look at Aquinas and Scotus in 10 minutes. So for Aquinas, the idea that God exists and that the person exists are to be understood analogically in the sense that existence is completely different in the two cases. The former is perfect, the latter is not. In this theology, God has created beings that are the effects of God and so manifest God, although imperfectly, because they are not God. So I think analogy is very important in understanding what holiness is, because we can't talk about it directly, we can only talk about it analogously and indirectly. And the analogia entis, the analogy of being, was key to Aquinas and the later theologians right down to the 20th century. Gets reinvigorated by that Polish contemporary of Heidegger, Erich Przyzwara. And I think there was some engagement with the two of them. And it's anathema to Protestant theology. There was Karl Barth. I was reading this only the other day. It's so funny. He invites Przyzwara to give a lecture, and Przyzwara goes and gives a lecture on the analogia entis. And Barth writes to his friend saying that the intellectual power of the Catholic Church is so much greater than our lot, you know. But I think it's the devil coming in, trying to get in. Because you can have no analogy of being, because God is so wholly other that there's nothing analogous in human life that could approach it for Barth, you know. Anyway. So the predicament is that on the one hand, terms such as wisdom that apply to persons cannot in truth be applied to God because God is transcendent and perfect. Yet such a term predicated of both person and God cannot be completely different because in that case we could know nothing at all about God in that and Aquinas' reasoning. Well, there must be something similar. So the terms or names applied to God cannot be purely equivocal or completely different in meaning when applied to persons and to God. On the other hand, terms such as wisdom cannot be meant univocally, just the one articulation, because the vast difference between their human application as inevitably imperfect and limited in contrast to the divine application to a perfect being. So Aquinas says, and there's a quote here on page 8, I'll just read it out. Yet, although we never use words in exactly the same sense of creatures and God, we are not merely equivocating when we use the same word, as some have said. For if this were so, we could never argue from statements about creatures to statements about God. Any such arguments would be invalidated by the fallacy of equivocation. That this is not That this does not happen, we know not merely from the teachings of the philosophers, who prove many thanks, that can't be right, who prove many thanks about God, but also from the teachings of St. Paul. Many things, that should be, not thanks, many things about God, but also from the teachings of St. Paul. When he says, the invisible things of God are made known by those things that are made. That's a quote from Scripture. We must say, therefore, that words are used of God and creatures in an analogical way, that is, in accordance with a certain order between them. So this analogical language, then, which it gets from Aristotle, moving down to the bottom of that page there, he says, in this analogical language, a word is used for two things, both of which have a relation to a third thing. Thus, for example, the word healthy might be used for a diet and a complexion, a healthy diet or a healthy complexion, where the former case, says Thomas, refers to a cause, and in the latter to an effect. Both cases are linked to the health in a person as either a cause or a symptom. Here the same word is used of two different things which have a relation to each other, as healthy is used of diet and the human animal, because diet is the cause of health in the human animal, he says. So there we are. So the doctrine of analogy is thus between univocity, that you can only say one thing about something, and equivocity, there's a there's an equivalence of things said. So equivocity, that posits such wide distinction between the being of God and the being of creature, and univocity, that posits you can only, there's only one thing, one voice, as it were. But so he says analogy is between these. Now, I've only got 5 minutes. So Scotus says, okay, Scotus comes in and says, no, that can't be right. Because of the doctrine because of the reality of human life, of life as we experience, we understand life in its particularity. So there aren't, what takes precedence is not that there are no universals, but what is important in human life are the stones that you bump into when you go for a walk. It's the particularity of life as lived here and now. And he calls the individuality of the stone, he calls it hetitas, thisness. And this is the primary reality for a Scotus, thisness, hetitas. And that is a univocity. It's what says Thomas Hopkins again. It says, myself it speaks and sings, what I do is me, for that I came. It's that univocity, that one voice of the stone or whatever it is. But Scotus's problem is, okay, if everything is particular and individuated, a bit like the Vaisheshikas thought, I suppose, how can we call that a stone and that a stone? What do they share? And that's where he goes into the universal. It's the universal particular. The particularity is a universal idea. So that allows there to be particular things that all stones can participate in the category stone, while the emphasis is on their particularity. Likewise with you and I. So that's his critique of the kind of Aquinian emphasis on universals, I suppose, really. So he wishes to affirm the universality of being in both the human and divine case. God exists and the person exists, and both share the same sense of the term exists. Now, isn't that weird and radical? 1300, he's saying that. He's giving lectures up here in Oxford, probably, I don't know where, probably down in Blackfriars, wasn't there then, was it? I don't think, but anyway, he'd be giving lectures and saying you've got particularities and you've got God, you've got the being of God and you've got the being of stones, and they both participate in being. Shock, horror. So he's subordinating God to being. And that's why Heidegger likes him. He wrote a book about him, wrote his thesis on him. Subordinating God to being. Of course, later theologians come along and say, Scotus, you can't do that. You can't subordinate God to being. So, therefore, he wishes to affirm the universality of being in both the human and divine case. God exists, the person exists, but they both share exists. While predicates such as is wise or is just are used distinctly of God and the human without the same meaning, because God is perfect and the human being is not, it doesn't follow that they share nothing. They share being. One cannot doubt that God is infinite being. One can doubt that God is infinite being, but not that God is being. You can doubt if God is infinite. Perhaps he had a mum and dad, but you can't doubt that he is. You can't doubt the existence of God, the being of God. So as Etienne Gilson, the great scholar of Scotus, says, human and stone are different species, but a human unity is not specifically different in him from the unity in the stone. These two entities, in truth, only differ numerically. So it's a very radical thesis, I think, that Scotus is propounding here. I'll let you read all this in your own course. So perhaps one other thing before I sum up what I'm trying to get at is the other distinction, that the other important thing. Okay, Scotus says hesitas, thisness, univocity, univocitas, and what he calls the formal distinction. It's another important idea that he comes up with. There's only a formal distinction between a holy person or a holy object and the property of holiness. It's simply formal and not real. So, so it's because of hetitas, Scotus's notion of hetitas, it's this shrine or this person that's regarded as holy. But you can't distinguish between, you can't abstract holiness. Holiness is not something other than its instantiation, than its embodiment in the particular. So I think that's what we can take from Scotus in an understanding of holiness, is the understanding is the formal, there's only a formal distinction between holiness and its instantiations in particular persons or particular entities. I'll talk about this more in the last lecture, but it's a formal distinction, not a real distinction, because of hetitas. So, finally, just summing up, but in way of conclusion, the Scotus model seems to take the infinite as an intellectual object that is realised within the context of everyday living. And there's no loss of distance from the subject. Now, Scotus's concerns have contemporary relevance for a phenomenology of holiness. On the one hand, by identifying the constraining power of particularity, hetitas, a force that controls events into what they are, and on the other, by identifying the formal distinction that a symbolic form of forms of holiness, its cultural and historical instantiations, are only formally distinct from the being of holiness. There can be no real distinction. So while we can abductively argue for a transcultural source of holiness, we cannot, in practice, distinguish instantiations of holiness from the being of holiness itself. Holiness itself and the appearances of holiness are distinct, but only formally so. So in order to develop a phenomenology of holiness, I've gone into the history of the notion of analogy and univocity and particularity from Scotus, because I think that we can develop something from Scotus, which there's an emphasis on hetitas, on thisness, and which we can't distinguish. there's only a formal distinction between holiness and its instantiations. And this is useful in a wider cultural application in terms of the history of civilizations, where we're looking at the different languages, different cultural forms, different cultural affordances that press into holiness in different ways, what I've called holiness.